Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Yes, we will talk about the news this morning, the Cuomo budget deal. Christiane Amanpour will join us on covering democracy and at home and abroad later this hour and more. But first,
yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Let's acknowledge that today is the 70th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the surprise attack by Japan that drew the United States into World War II, one of the most famous as well as infamous days in American history. And you all know that clip, but here is 30 seconds of what WNYC sounded like that day.
All officers of the United States Army must report to duty at once. The commandant of the Brooklyn Navy Yard orders all officers and men in the New York area to report at once to their ships, stations, or yards. The recruiting division of the United States Navy announces that its recruiting offices will be open from 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. A word to listeners. Your city station WNYC will remain on the air for an indefinite period tonight to bring New Yorkers news, emergency public service messages, and special announcements and orders from naval and army authorities in the city area. This is New York City's own station, WNYC.
Yes, and we don't know who that announcer was, but I believe that in those days WNYC had to sign off at sunset. He said WNYC would stay on the air round the clock because of the breaking news and the emergency situation. And I guess that's how they talked in those days, right? Nobody today sounds exactly like that person who sounded so 1941. But we have a Pearl Harbor historian with us, and we are opening the phones for anyone who remembers where you were when you first heard the news about Pearl Harbor. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Our guest is Stephen Gillen, University of Oklahoma professor and resident historian for the History Channel. His new book is Pearl Harbor, FDR Leads the Nation into War. Professor Gillen, thanks for doing this on the anniversary day. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
And listeners, we know some of you out there right now are old enough to remember Pearl Harbor. The question is simple. Where were you when you first heard the news? Call us and remember it on the air for the younger generations to hear. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, Professor, since we're asking people to recall when they heard the news, your book mentions in the first few pages that the attack took place on a Sunday around dinner time in the East, which meant that most Americans did not have their radios on. How did word spread about the attack?
Well, one of the interesting things I learned was just how slowly news of Pearl Harbor spread around the country. Most people were outdoors. They weren't around their radio. And even though the report started coming in around 2:30 or so, it took until later in the evening. It was really the newspapers, when the newspapers came out with their extra editions with the screaming headlines stating war, that Americans understood what had taken place. You're talking about people and their memories. I was talking to my dad, who's 80 years old now, and he was 9 years old at the time, and he was telling me about, he was a kid, and he went to the movies. He saw a Clark Gable movie that afternoon with his father, and when they walked out of the movie theater, they had all these young kids with these papers, and the headline was war, and that's when it sort of struck them that what had taken place and what the significance was. And my dad kept asking my grandfather, what does it mean, Dad? What does it mean? And my grandfather said, you know, I don't know. I just don't know. And I think that's true of most Americans. They didn't immediately make the connection between the Japanese attacking this base in the Pacific, and most Americans had never heard of Oahu, and the events that were taking place in Europe. And that's something that would take place then over the next couple of days.
And just to be clear about the clock on that day, you wrote traditional Sunday dinner time. Did you mean early afternoon, East time, East Coast time?
Yeah, on East Coast, people, East Coast and the Midwest, people ate dinner at 1 p.m.
And the attack was at 1:47.
Yeah, Roosevelt learned of the attack at 1:47. The first news reports, I think 2:28 was the first radio broadcast, and after 2:30 or so, most of the stations were reporting news of the attack.
Walter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hello.
And you remember Pearl Harbor Day?
I was 4 years old. I was in Ebbets Field in Brooklyn with my dad watching a pro football game, and they announced it on the public announce system, and we all stood and sang the national anthem.
Wow, they announced it on the PA system. Do you remember who was playing?
Well, it was the Brooklyn Football Dodgers and someone else. This was like the B League. This wasn't the immediate precursor of the NFL, but it was like a lesser league.
You were ahead of your time, Walter. You were spending Sunday afternoon watching football before most Americans. Do you remember?
I just like to say that, as I recall, in those days, it was considered a sign of disrespect for the nation to applaud at the end of the national anthem.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate your memory. Jan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Brian. Good morning.
You remember Pearl Harbor Day?
Absolutely. It was 3 weeks short of my 14th birthday. We were living in a row house in Laurelton, Queens. And we had an eating kitchen. We were in the kitchen and the radio was on. And I was there with my mother and dad. We were thunderstruck. We didn't know what to make of it. But obviously mother and dad were very concerned about it, and I was trying to figure out what was it all about, and we just couldn't believe that this had happened. And I can still see the room so clearly as though it were yesterday. The room overlooked our little garden. It was just such a blow to our way of life. It came so suddenly and so unexpectedly, and it's one of those days that will live, as Roosevelt said, in infamy, but it remains in your memory. And that's a long, long time ago, but it's just as though it were yesterday. I can see the room clearly. I can see what the furniture looked like, the linoleum on the floor, the whole thing.
Do you remember if it made some of the grown-up men around you feel patriotic or express patriotic words? Did it make them run to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and enlist, as we heard people asked to do in that WNYC newscast?
Well, Brian, I'll tell you, my father did serve in World War I, and he got in September of 17, and he was out by November of 17, so that was his Army service. And I had cousins who went to war, yes. I had male cousins on my father's side of the family, and I think three or four, I think they probably all went. Because I was the youngest in that side of the family. But at that time, it was just my mother, father, and I, and we were very close with our neighbors, and we were fortunate, as it turned out, to have a butcher for a neighbor. So during the war, when the rationing went on, we were able to, I think we traded some of our gas coupons for meat. So that was useful. Yeah,
That was a different time, a different era of what war was like for Americans, certainly. Jen, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. My guest is Stephen Gillen, resident historian for the History Channel and author of a brand new book called Pearl Harbor, FDR Leads the Nation into War, the attack on Pearl Harbor 70 years ago today. And we're taking your memories of that day at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Professor Gillen, you're right that initially military officials on Hawaii were reluctant to give details of the damage assessment at Pearl Harbor to the president. Why was that?
Well, there was no direct line, first of all, from Hawaii to the White House. So Admiral Block in Pearl Harbor would call to Admiral Stark in the War Department. Stark would then call over to the White House, where Grace Tully, the president's secretary, would take shorthand and then go over to a typewriter and type up memos, which she would then hand to the president. So the communication was difficult to begin with. And then Admiral Block in Pearl Harbor could not, the line he was speaking on was not a secure line. And he was afraid the Japanese were listening in. And the fear was that if the Japanese knew how devastating the attack had been, that they would launch a land invasion. Of course, the Japanese knew exactly what damage they had done, but we didn't know that. So Block, at one point, is reluctant to tell Stark exactly how bad the damage was. And Stark says to him, you know, Claude, just tell me the truth. Tell me how bad it is. So not only was the communication difficult, but even when they were able to make communications, Block was unwilling to give a full report. And the other problem is that, and as Roosevelt said that night, for every piece of accurate information he received, there were 9 pieces that were inaccurate. I mean, there were early reports. There were reports that two of the planes had swastikas on them, that there was one aircraft carrier. The General Marshall called Roosevelt at around 2:30 and told him that there were 50 Japanese airplanes. I mean, there was so much misinformation that Roosevelt spends most of the day just trying to sort fact from fiction. And what he's really worried about is, what is Japan's intent? I mean, he doesn't know how many planes attacked. He doesn't know until much later on in the evening just how feeble the American response had been. And then the question is, what's Japan going to do next? Is Japan going to invade Hawaii? At dinner that night, he said that if the Japanese continued and invaded the west coast of the United States, they could proceed as far as Chicago before we would be able to stop them. So there's just this sense, when you go back and look at those 24-hour periods, you just get a sense of the confusion, the chaos, and the fear that gripped not only the nation, but also the White House itself.
April in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You remember Pearl Harbor Day? April, you there?
Yes.
Hi.
I wasn't born yet, but my brother had just been born in Salisbury, North Carolina. And I think he'd been born a day or so before, because they used to keep you in the hospital for 2 weeks when you had a baby. And the doctors came running in because they knew my father was a geology professor, and they asked him, where is Pearl Harbor? And apparently they forgot to circumcise him because in all the disturbance.
That's funny. And did he ever, you don't have to tell me. Ross in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ross.
Hi.
You remember?
I was in my brother's bedroom. We were listening to the Eagles football game. He had a very bad strep throat, and my mother was downstairs with the doctor, who was telling her he hoped David wouldn't have to go to the hospital. We heard the announcement, and I screamed, and mother came tearing upstairs. And when I told her the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, she said, oh, thank God.
What?
She said, oh, thank God.
Why?
Because she thought it, my brother was...
You thought your brother... I see. I get it.
I mean, it very soon became a serious thing, but...
Right, of course.
Many years later, we used to laugh about...
She was concerned about his health. I get it. That's a funny story. Professor, do you know who wrote that speech? You know, we played the clip, and we're going to play a different clip in a minute, one that people don't hear all the time about, you know, the day that we'll live in infamy. We all know that clip. Do you know who wrote that speech?
Sure.
or what decisions they had to make about what exactly to include or leave out?
Absolutely. It's a great story. Roosevelt sat down with Grace Tully, his secretary, at around 5 o'clock and dictated, in her words, without pause or hesitation, the essence of the speech he gave the next day. She typed it up and gave it back to him, and he took the first line. Originally, the first line said, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in world history. And Roosevelt pulled out his pen, and he crossed out world history, and he wrote the word infamy. That night, Harry Hopkins made a couple of suggestions, but Roosevelt's speechwriters were away. He wrote the speech, nearly every word in the speech, by himself. And what's fascinating about it is we remember it now as one of the great examples of presidential oratory. The fact is that his three most senior foreign policy advisors, the Secretary of War, Secretary of State, and Secretary of the Navy, objected to the speech. And when he met with his cabinet that night, they ganged up on Roosevelt. They wanted him to do two things. One is to give a longer address. Roosevelt was convinced that he needed to give a short address, less than 500 words, because he wanted people to listen to it on radio. And secondly, more importantly, they wanted him to use the occasion to declare war on Germany and Italy as well. And Roosevelt refused it. It's one of these great, you know, you talk about what makes a president great. And I think what makes Roosevelt great is that in a moment like that, on a critical issue of war and peace, he trusted his own instincts and he rejected the unanimous recommendation of his foreign policy advisors. And it turns out that he was right.
Stephen Gillen, author of Pearl Harbor, FDR Leads the Nation into War. And here are two different short sections of that speech than we usually hear. It's FDR on December 8th, 1941. These two clips together total just over a minute.
It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island.
Professor Gillen, the Japanese military had a busy December 7th.
They sure did. What's interesting about the speech, what Roosevelt did is after he did the initial draft with Grace Tully, he took the draft and he stuck it into his coat pocket. And throughout the day and even the next morning, as he was getting updates on the breadth of this Japanese attack, he would take out the speech and in pencil add sort of a new location that had been overwhelmed by the Japanese. So he was keeping tabs of all the places that the Japanese attacked that day.
Leonard in Livingston, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leonard.
Hi.
You remember hearing that speech, huh?
I remember very well the football game between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants, and I remember that also the Japanese were constantly having trouble and giving trouble in the Far East, and we thought, well, they're going to apologize as they always did. So I did hear about it on the radio, I guess. The next day at Great Hall at City College, we were all assembled there to hear Franklin D. Roosevelt's speech.
Do you remember your reaction to it at that time?
Well, we were all worried and concerned, and this was not one of the apologies that was going to come from the Japanese that time.
Do you remember how similar or differently you felt on 9/11?
Well, I was a lot older then. 9/11, I was working in a local hospital as a volunteer, and I remember going to work and hearing it on radio, and we were alerted to at the hospital to see if we could volunteer the next day if we were needed.
Mm. Leonard, thank you very much for calling. It's amazing, Professor, how many of our callers were listening to that football Giants versus football Dodgers game on the radio. I'm telling you, half the board is people say, oh, I was listening to that football game, and the one guy called and said he was at the football game.
Yeah.
So football already was the American pastime on Sunday afternoons in 1941.
Yeah, it was also a big game, the Philadelphia Eagles versus the Washington Redskins in Washington, and they chose not to make the announcement there, and so it's not to cause panic. So they called individually the various military officers who they needed, which made people very suspicious. And one of the people who was at that game watching was a ensign named John F. Kennedy.
Mm. But Ann in Koskob, who was in Buffalo at the time, wasn't listening to a football game, were you, Ann?
Not at all, and I still don't much. But there were people listening to Phil Spitalny and his all-girl orchestra. We were there after at my grandmother's after dinner, and I was the only one listening to the radio. The rest of the family was at the other end of the room talking, and I remember looking at the face of that radio. It was sort of a rounded shape with fabric in the front, and I did not understand any of the implications of what Roosevelt was saying, but I just remember thinking about the mystery of this radio, what it was telling me.
How old were you?
I was 8. And, of course, when I then reported to the rest of the family, I've never had an audience like that since.
And thank you very much. And, Professor, it's amazing how our listeners are recalling the texture of things, how things felt, how things looked, the linoleum on the kitchen floor.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how events like that, you know, there are different moments that register with each generation. And for my parents' generation, it was Pearl Harbor. For my generation, it was the Kennedy assassination. And for the generation today, I think it's going to be 9/11. We all remember where we were and remember details about our lives that we otherwise would have forgotten.
Before you go,
yeah,
you conclude in your book that Roosevelt's successful leadership that day depended on a level of deception
yeah,
that would be unacceptable by today's standards. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think Roosevelt did two things. Number one, he deliberately downplayed the amount of damage when he met with congressional leaders. He met with his cabinet and told them all the details that he had in front of him. Then he said to them, I'm meeting with congressional leaders. I'm not going to tell them all these things. So he deceived congressional leaders. Also deceives the public. You know, Roosevelt's worried that there will be a backlash against him if the public finds out just how bad this attack had been and how feeble the American response was. So Roosevelt deliberately manages the news. He makes sure that he is the White House is the sole source of information for news, and he deliberately downplays the amount of damage that took place. So, you know, there are more modern, sophisticated methods at news management today, but in terms of the technology back in the day, back in 1941, the White House was able to essentially cut off all communication from Hawaii so that the White House was the sole source of information. Today, and certainly if you look at the Iraq War, the White House has found other more sophisticated ways of managing the news, but I think both would qualify as being deceptive.
Stephen M. Gillen, resident historian for the History Channel and a University of Oklahoma professor. His brand new book is called Pearl Harbor, FDR Leads the Nation into War. The Pearl Harbor attack 70 years ago today. Listeners, thank you so much for your calls with your memories. And Professor Gillen, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, everything about the Cuomo budget deal other than the tax rates. Stay tuned.